Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people's story and events in Iowa. I'm Gail Seiler, your host for today. Thanks for tuning in. Well, the weather has finally turned the corner, and it's looking and feeling a bit more like spring. Most days this week, the forecast includes daytime highs above freezing. Today will be 34 and mainly sunny. Tuesday will bring a high of 37, but with some freezing rain. Wednesday will be even warmer with a high of 54 and rain. On Thursday, some rain showers will continue and it will be in the 40s. Then on Friday, we'll have mixed sun and clouds and a high of 34. Overall, it will be wet and messy, but starting to feel like winter is leaving us. On today's show, we'll hear how ISU students responded to a visit by a self-proclaimed white nationalist this past week. We'll also have excerpts from the International Women's Day celebration that took place on Friday evening at the Ames Library. And in the last part of the show, Keith Morgan from Story County Emergency Management will join us. But first, we have Dennis Hart with news from across Iowa.
Thanks very much, Gail, for having me back on this Monday. Politics made big news around the state last week, as it is likely to do many times between now and next year's presidential election. Let's start with the newest Des Moines Register CNN Mediacom Iowa poll, which came out yesterday, showing that former Democratic Vice President Joe Biden, who has not yet entered the 2020 presidential race, is leading the pack of presidential contenders among likely Democratic caucus-goers. Biden is the first choice of 27%, followed by Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, who is at 25%. Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren is third, with 9%. Sanders kicked off his Iowa campaign with a series of rallies this past week. Among other things, he railed against Wall Street, criticized billionaires and the growing gap between the nation's rich and poor, talked about the high cost of prescription drugs and medical care, and promised to support whoever the eventual Democratic nominee is, if it's not him. Other Democratic presidential contenders also showed up in Iowa last week, including Washington Governor Jay Inslee and former Colorado Governor John Hickenlooper. Also last week, voters in Des Moines and five other cities in Polk County approved a 1 cent sales tax hike. More than 70% of Des Moines voters backed the increase, and it easily passed in West Des Moines, Altoona, and three other cities. The tax hike is expected to generate more than $48 million each year, money that will be used to reduce property taxes and pay for various civic projects. Meanwhile, the Iowa Supreme Court decided this past Friday that transgender people can use Medicaid funds to pay for transition-related care, including surgeries. The court's unanimous decision struck down the administrative code governing Medicaid in Iowa, which had banned surgeries for the purpose of sex reassignment. There was plenty of other news around the state last week, including word that the man accused of killing University of Iowa student Molly Tibbetts claims he was not read his rights before police interviewed him. Lawyers for suspect Christian Bahena Rivera are arguing that any confession he made was involuntary. They also want the trial moved out of Poweshiek County and into a county with more minority representation. The 24-year-old Rivera was charged with first-degree murder in the stabbing death of the 20-year-old Tibbetts after he led investigators to her body in a rural Poweshiek County cornfield last year. Also last week, authorities said an armed Des Moines man opened fire on three city police officers before they shot and killed him. The confrontation followed a vehicle theft and shooting that injured one person. That shooting victim told officers that two men stole his sport utility vehicle and that one of them shot him in the leg. Minutes later, officers found the stolen vehicle. Three people inside fled on foot, and a man identified as 36-year-old Luke Swan allegedly fired multiple gunshots at police, who returned fire and killed him. Also in Des Moines, the body of a homicide victim was found in a parking lot this past Saturday. He was identified as 25-year-old Darren Bowles Brooks. There was grim news out of eastern Iowa last week. Authorities confirmed that human remains found buried on the property of a Cedar Rapids home were those of a missing Iowa man. 31-year-old Christopher Bagley of Walker was positively identified. He had been stabbed to death. Bagley had last been seen in mid-December. In Ames this past Friday, a semi-driver died after his trailer crashed and burst into flames under an Interstate 35 overpass. The semi was traveling east on U.S. Highway 30 and slammed into the barriers underneath the southbound lanes of I-35. In West Des Moines, a man died after his Jeep ran into a tree while a police officer tried to catch up with him. The Jeep was being driven erratically when the officer spotted it and began following the vehicle. When the officer tried to catch up with the driver, the Jeep hit a tree, fatally injuring the driver. No one else was inside the vehicle. Meanwhile, a 76-year-old Iowa man died in a single car crash in the northeast part of the state on Saturday. He was identified as Eugene Lampe. He was driving an SUV west of Sumner when he lost control. And an Oskaloosa garbage truck driver died last week when he got caught by his truck's compactor mechanism. He was identified as 39-year-old Robert Evans. There was also word last week that six Iowa nursing home employees had been indicted for obtaining prescription drugs that were meant for the people they were caring for. Four women from the Des Moines Metro and two from Southern Iowa were accused of diverting drugs from nursing home residents to themselves. And there was word that a new survey from the Iowa Department of Public Health shows that about one student inside each Iowa classroom has either thought about or attempted suicide in the past year. One in 10 students reported they had a plan for suicide, while one in 20 said they'd actually attempted it. Meanwhile, there was word last week that leaders in the Dubuque Community School District are proposing that staffers be equipped with a panic button app on their smartphones that could alert coworkers and 911 dispatchers to an emergency. A $30,000 a year contract for use of the app is expected to be considered at today's, Monday's, board meeting. The app lets users press a button for the type of emergency that is happening, such as an active intruder, a fire, a medical issue, or an incident requiring a police response. The app would call 911 and send an automatic alert to all relevant staff members. Meanwhile, a Central Iowa man who claimed he was defending himself when he punched a construction worker at an Urbandale bar, causing injuries that led to the man's death, was convicted last week of second-degree murder. Jurors found 49-year-old Rodney Henriksen guilty in the killing of Joshua Sadland of Wisconsin. Henriksen punched Sadland in the head and face before slamming him onto the concrete floor. Sadland died the next day. Henriksen faces up to 50 years in prison. He will be sentenced April 15th. In another case, a Des Moines man was sentenced to more than 15 years in federal prison for distributing child pornography. 35-year-old Joseph Marchesini was also ordered to undergo 8 years of supervised release after his prison term. And an 18-year-old man from Mason City has now been accused of sex extortion schemes in three Iowa counties. Christian Gosweiler has already been given probation after pleading guilty in Story County. Now he's accused of similar crimes in Blackhawk and Scott counties. In the town of Bagley in Guthrie County, residents were warned last week not to drink tap water after unsafe levels of manganese were discovered in the public water supply. The town is about 60 miles northwest of Des Moines, and it has about 300 residents. Hy-Vee took more than 16,000 bottles of water to those affected. Also last week, hundreds of people showed up at the state capitol in Des Moines to oppose a pair of bills aimed at limiting the ability of governments and private groups to buy new land for conservation and public use. A bill in the Iowa House would have stopped state and local governments from buying new lands under most circumstances. More than a dozen people spoke out against the bill during a subcommittee hearing, and the bill failed to make it out of that subcommittee. Meanwhile, a California animal rescue group sued an Iowa animal shelter, claiming it's really a puppy mill masquerading as a rescue group so it can gain access to the West Coast pet market. The Animal Legal Defense Fund calls the setup a puppy laundering scheme designed to get around California's ban on pet stores selling animals from commercial breeders. The organization says a California group called Bark Adoptions is buying puppies from Rescue Pets Iowa to sell at Animal Kingdom pet stores in California. Also last week, word that the Valley West Mall in Des Moines will rebrand itself as Valley West Commons as part of a redevelopment plan that will transform the 44-year-old shopping center, adding more restaurants and entertainment venues. The project could take up to 10 years. And there was a report that residential rents in downtown Des Moines had dropped as much as 16% last year, according to a survey published by CBRE Hubble Commercial. The reason? A sharp increase in the number of rental units, resulting in vacancies not seen since 2010. Meanwhile, the suburbs are experiencing climbing rental rates. In sports last week, Iowa State University's men's and women's basketball teams were both in action. The women's team defeated Kansas 69-49, then began play in the Big 12 tournament by again defeating Kansas. The men's team lost to West Virginia 90-75, then lost to Texas Tech 80-73. Another sports note, Iowa State University's athletic director, Jamie Pollard, was named the 2018-2019 Athletic Director of the Year by the National Association of Collegiate Directors of Athletics last week. One last story before we go, this one about the big fish that did not get away. Royce Crumman, a farmer from Lake Park, has fished his way into the Iowa record books by catching the state's biggest yellow perch at a private lake in Dickinson County. How big was it, you ask? The yellow perch weighed in at 2.79 pounds and was 16.4 inches long. But big as that was, it wasn't a world's record. That was made in New Jersey when a 4.3-pound whopper was caught way back in 1865. But here's to Royce Crummett, who certainly had what it took to make his way into our state's fishing history books. And that's your summary of the week's news from around Iowa. I'm Dennis Hart, taking the next few days off, but planning to be perched right back here in this seat on Friday after I fished around for what made news in Ames. In the meantime, have a great week.
Okay, well, thank Dennis for that news update and all the puns. On Local Talk on Friday, you heard reporting from ISU's campus when Nicholas Fuentes, a white nationalist with an online following, came to the university. It was unclear who invited him to campus. Rumors were that he was invited by one or both of two student groups, the College Republicans or by Turning Point USA. Despite that lack of clarity, as the word spread that Nicholas Fuentes would be there on Wednesday evening, individuals and student groups mobilized to respond. Today, we have some more information on that. We have some reflection from student leaders about what transpired and the impact that it had. First, we'll hear from Taylor Blair, who is with Campus Democrats at ISU, and then from Alexis Holmes, who is with the Black Student Alliance.
So we had actually heard a little bit before that he was coming, and so we had a little bit of time to do research into him, who he was, what he stood for, the things he said, and just a lot of really repugnant things, right? Like the First Amendment wasn't written for Muslims. Multiculturalism is a cancer, which I believe I did see on the live stream, he said, again, at Iowa State. Just like meeting with like Richard Spencer, he was at Charlottesville at the Unite the Right rally, and we support the First Amendment, of course, free speech. But we also see that there is a line between free speech and hate speech. And hate speech puts people's lives and safety in danger. You know, when people speak openly and it's accepted that this is something people can do, you know, talk about we need to deport all the people of color out of our country, you know, like using dog whistles for Jewish people, that leads to hate crimes, that leads to people getting hurt. And, you know, we see the hate crimes rising. And, you know, people like Nicholas Fuentes being allowed to just speak anywhere with no repercussions adds to that. The stuff he was saying does not reflect the values of our university. You know, a lot of trolls have attacked our Twitter recently saying, well, why don't you just debate him? Why are you scared? Why are you shutting down free speech? And I would say, like, I would love to have a conversation about how to make our country better. But he's not here to have a real good faith conversation. He's here to stir up hate. These kind of ideas, like I said earlier, lead to violence, lead to division and hatred. And that's nothing that Iowa State should be supporting. I was so proud of our community for showing up so strongly like they did and like just explicitly rejecting him. Some people engaged directly with him. They were like arguing back and forth with him or debating back and forth with him. But then there's also people, you know, singing songs and, you know, having solidarity and were there in his space and like taking it back for themselves. And I was really, you know, heartened by seeing that. I thought that was a really beautiful response to his hate. I think it plays into the larger issue here where we see a lot of times that groups like Turning Point USA, some conservative groups in general, bringing very controversial speakers to campus, almost, it seems to me, an attempt to get shut down so that they can play this card of victim, I'm being shut down. And what I think that does, the whole idea, the whole conversation about centering it on free speech instead of what they're actually saying, allows them to get away with saying really hateful things. What happens is it's kind of a win-win either way for these really hateful speakers, because if they win if they come on campus and spread their message, and they win if they get shut down or they get counter-protesters, because then they can fall back on this narrative of the repressed conservative voice on campus that colleges are liberal havens that are brainwashing our children. You know, so like they win either way. When I talk to students on campus, when I register them to vote, when we talk about who they're going to vote for in the election, like there is a wide range of political opinions on campus. But what captures the attention of media, what captures the attention of average people is the every once in a while when a neo-Nazi gets shut down on a campus. And it just changes the narrative completely from what it actually exists on campus, which is a free exchange of ideas, and turns it into these very focused debates on should a neo-Nazi be able to speak on campus. And it just distracts and divides.
Was it evident that he had supporters there among the crowd when he was speaking?
that's actually the weird part about it. For me personally, from my angle, from the people that I've talked to and the people that I've moved around, no, because I've talked to people from PR, and I've talked to people who popped up, and they're like, we don't know either, we don't know this person, or we know who he is, and we don't like anything that comes out of his mouth. There was no one that was boldly, that I saw, there was no one boldly supporting him. There was no one visibly, like, pro Nick. We were all just kind of figuring out, like, who are you? Why are you here? Who brought you here?
I understand that there was a lot of time when people were waiting to see what was going to happen when he wasn't there yet. And there were some interesting actual dialogues between different factions. And do you think that maybe anything good came out of this in terms of communication, better communication between people?
I do feel like there is some slight positive outcome just because there was an opportunity to see that, you know, I don't want to say, like, my enemy's enemy is my friend. But it came down to a point where, okay, I don't agree with most of the things that you may stand for or believe. However, I also understand that you may not stand for everything that I think you stand for. And I also felt like it was beneficial because with those private dialogues and the different conversations that took place, a lot of people were open to new perspectives and kind of getting that understanding of, okay, what is my perspective? How do I challenge this? What forms this? How do I move on from this, and how do I make sure the information I'm getting, I'm taking into account the sources that I am receiving it from? It was a very stressful night for everyone to just be out and realize that, wow, not only do people like him still exist, it's the fact that the narratives that he's still pushing on and the narratives he's still supporting, you know, those things are still alive and well. But I try to give myself enough emotional, mental space because that was a pretty overwhelming night. Amazing to see such like a variety of people come out for such a similar purpose, and I think it's going to be hard to find a balance of not giving an internet troll attention and also letting people know that if you come out here, you will be opposed. But yeah, just hopefully in the future we just are able to band together and have even more productive discussions and events, and I just hope that we're a lot more mindful about who is allowed on campus and how we go about either getting them off of campus or just choosing better, like choosing better people and being accountable for whoever comes.
That was Taylor Blair from ISU Campus Democrats, followed by Alexis Holmes from the Black Student Alliance at ISU. We're talking about the appearance of a white nationalist on campus last week. As mentioned in that last interview, while the students were waiting to see what was going to happen and if the speaker was going to arrive, conversations began between students from different groups and different points of view. KHOI intern and reporter Trey Moore happened to capture one of these conversations between Alexis Holmes from the Black Student Alliance, whom we just heard, and a member of the Campus Republicans, Anthony LaBruna.
I agree with you on some of those points, especially, you know, if Turning Point didn't invite him, then he shouldn't be on this campus. That's why, you know, the officers were here. And I understand, but he's no figurehead for, like, the Republican Party.
Right.
Like,
but I'm just
if anything,
figurehead for
the
his
vile
personal ideals.
Yeah. Like, the vile stuff he says shouldn't be tolerated, especially from the conservatives and the Republican Party. You may have your own viewpoints, but at the end of the day, like, some of the things he says is just so, like, just degrading. You know, I know it allows him a platform to grow, but then that's got to go to the organization that invited him.
Someone has to be a little bit more firm in them saying, yes, we invited this person, or no, we didn't. Because it also kind of is reflective on them as, and I don't want to say an org, but it reflects on them as a gathering of people who aren't strong enough to stand by something that they have or haven't done to make an official statement of, no, this wasn't us, or yes, this was us. And like you're saying, stand by that throughout the whole process.
Yeah, I can agree with that, especially because I think free speech is probably, like, the best thing we have as college students because, you know, we're still, you know, at university trying to learn. And as we work through our, you know, our what we're learning, that intellectual diversity on campus makes us better human beings at the end of the day. What he says, that's not really – he's not teaching anything.
While we have to have dialogues and different things about this debate, there needs to be a dialogue itself about that freedom of speech. Because I feel like what a lot of people have done with it is, like, typically that when it was established, it was typically, hey, you're able to speak out against the government. You know, you're able to I guess, like, voiced your concerns and your like the different things that you have that you want to discuss in an appropriate manner. However, I feel like a lot of people have translated free speech to is something where I can say anything I want off the top of my head and have no consequences from anybody. So I feel like a conversation needs to happen about that, what freedom of speech truly means, because we do have a right to talk to each other and voice our opinions, but I think we have to understand that our freedom of speech applies to us talking to our government in a respectful, constructive manner, and not just, oh, I can say what I want about you personally or about this group of people with no type of repercussions for my actions. Or something has to be established with that, because I feel like a lot of lines become blurred with that, and that's where people throw out, oh, this is my First Amendment right, but then it's like, that doesn't apply to this conversation. And I feel like that's something that has been entwined a lot within just generations in general.
Could I ask you, like, what do you mean by, like when you're asking, like, certain questions, like, it doesn't apply here? Like, what do you mean that doesn't apply to certain, like, language? Or, like, because I think, like, the idea, like, when you yell fire in a theater, that's technically against the law.
Right.
Calling violence against certain groups or minorities of people or even majorities of people, you know, I think that shouldn't be tolerated, because you're actually calling upon for violence onto people, cultures, religions, and et cetera. But I do believe that, like, the idea, you know, of conservative speakers and liberal speakers should be allowed, maybe in, you know, a form that is set up right. I believe there is a right way to set it up. Obviously, this wasn't the right way to set up a thing. But personally, what we were talking about before is going in there and talking and just hearing each other out on each side. I think that's more beneficial as students.
Right.
The negative impacts that such a speaker can have on people's lives was experienced by Preston Barris, a KHOI reporter who was present when Nicholas Fuentes, a white nationalist, was on campus last week. Preston tweeted about it that night, and we'll hear from him what happened after that.
The next morning, I woke up and found out that the white supremacist in question, Nick Fuentes, found my tweet somehow, which was interesting because I did not use his name. He found it somehow, retweeted it, and then his fan base proceeded to do what is called brigading, which is a tactic where they pretty much just overwhelm you with messages or responses to what you said on Twitter. Yeah, and most of it was attacking me for, like, based on what they could tell from my tweets or my pictures I had on there. A lot of slurs, mostly related to them calling me gay, or a lot of attacks on my masculinity, saying that I was a beta or a soy boy, as they call it, because they seem to think that eating soybeans makes you less of a man. It's interesting. I think their insults tend to say more about them than it does the people they're insulting. But
once they identified you, they were able to look at other things you had tweeted or other things you had tagged and
yeah,
so on.
They could just
they learned a lot about you just by being part of your Twitter feed.
I have a very, like, small amount of followers on Twitter, so I tend to be pretty free about what I say.
Mm-hmm.
And once I got targeted by that audience, they were able to just go and see everything I tweeted in the past, my bio, which has references to where I work. And a lot of stuff where they could easily dox me if they wanted to, which is a tactic where they will reveal personal information and use it to harass people in real life, which was my main concern from all of this. But it doesn't look like that happened. But that was a concern of mine that kept me reading the things that they were sending my way, because I wanted to just make sure that they weren't doing that. And this is not without precedent. This has happened in the past to many people. I wasn't too scared of it happening to me, just because I'm not the biggest target. It feels more like a 5 minutes of infamy sort of thing.
But still very unsettling.
Unsettling, and enough that I just, for my own peace of mind, wanted to make sure that that wasn't going to happen to me. Normally when I hear about, like, internet bullying or something, my first thought is, well, just walk away from the computer. It sounds simple. But because doxing is something I know that this group of people does and will rely on as a tactic, I just wanted to have a handle on the conversation. I wanted to know what was being said, so that I knew that if I needed to start fearing for my personal safety, that I was aware of that potential problem. a lot of these people were tweeting slurs at me, homophobic slurs, racial slurs, all sorts of stuff, and ableist slurs, a lot of that. And so Twitter like automatically detects those words, and in order to view tweets with those words, you have to say show me this thing that has offensive content. So I had to do that on a lot of the tweets. The tweets also had a lot of openly neo-Nazi and white supremacist leanings.
I'm glad to hear that it's dying down, although I know it must have been upsetting.
It was stressful more than anything. It felt like my heart was just racing a bit faster throughout the day.
International Women's Day was Friday, March 8th, and there was a celebration at the Ames Public Library. The library auditorium was quite full, with almost 100 people. The theme was Balance for Better, which refers to the goal of gender parity for women. The celebration opened with a performance by the Ames High School step team, which really got everyone energized right from the start. And that was followed by a panel discussion with three women who hold elected office in central Iowa. Monique Binkin from the Ames School Board, Bronwyn Beatty Hansen, Ames City Council member, and Nikki Conrad, Webster County Supervisor. Also on the panel was Kelly Winfrey, who works with the Ready to Run program, which prepares women to run for office. The facilitator for the panel discussion was Karen Kodrowski, director of the CAT Center for Women and Politics at ISU. She opened the discussion with a question for Kelly Winfrey about the status of women in elected office nationally and locally. After that, we'll hear Monique Binkin and Bronwyn Beatty Hansen talking about intersectionality, and Nikki Conrad speaking about challenges she has faced as a Webster County supervisor.
One good thing to note is that 5 years ago, things looked different for women in politics, sometimes for worse and sometimes for better. But what we've seen in the recent election, both 2017 and 2018, are a lot more women serving in office. So the good news is that we've had more women run and win. I guess the opportunity lies in we're still not at gender parity. So about 24% of women in the, or 24% of the U.S. Congress is women. About 18% of governors are women. So again, you know, we think it'd be about 50% since women are about 50% of the population. We had some good successes here in Iowa. We have 45 women serving in the Iowa legislature now. That was up from 35 in the previous legislature. So that's a pretty big increase, about a 30% increase in one election cycle. So that's really awesome, and we're really excited about that. And kind of similarly, there were big increases in the U.S. Congress as well in 2018, but a lot of room for improvement. In Iowa counties, overall, 40% of county elected seats are held by women. Those are largely as auditors, recorders, and treasurers. We have much fewer women serving as county attorneys, sheriffs, or supervisors. And then I'll say in Story County, since that's where we're currently at, we are doing a little bit better because two of three of our board of supervisors are women. And we have a female attorney, auditor, and recorder. Looking at Iowa as a whole, in terms of the municipal government, so mayors and city council members, 26% of those are women, so we could do a lot better. 15% of mayors are women in Iowa, so there's a lot of opportunity in local government to get more women and you know, hopefully push them up the pipeline. But I'll add that in Ames, 3 of 6 of our city council members are women, and 4 of 7 of the school board members are women. So when we look really locally, we can say we're doing great right here, but we need to encourage a little bit outside of our boundaries. Every election cycle for the state legislature in Iowa since 2000, more than 50% of women that ran won their legislative campaigns in all but 1 year, and that was 49%. Several of those was around 60% or more. So I want to start by saying when women run, they win, and they can win a lot. And so, you know, there's a single, women do face sexism. There is a double bind that women encounter. There's lots of other things, but women do win in Iowa and nationally. And so don't let that be a reason you don't run. But in terms of barriers, I think that some of the big ones are in doubting your own qualifications. Research shows that women say they're less qualified to run for office than a man with the exact same resume. And I think that's important to note, that you don't have to have a PhD or a JD to run for office, for any office, really. I think the other thing is that women are encouraged less to run for office than men are. And research shows that's from their family, their friends, their coworkers, party leaders, etc. Women just aren't encouraged as much. So encourage women around you to run for office, because that's one of the big barriers, is just getting women in the race in the first place.
Feminists talk a great deal about intersectionality, and that is the idea that all people live at the intersection of multiple identities: race, sex, class, sexual orientation, gender expression, educational attainment, religion, ethnicity, you name it. Moreover, these multiple and overlapping identities shape our experiences and our worldviews. So for each of our elected officials, tell us how your intersectional identity shapes your worldview and your approach to public life. And I think we'll begin with Monique.
I'm actually a stickler for that term. And I actually, so when we use that term, I always default to the original meaning of the term, right? So created by Kimberly Crenshaw, who was an attorney, came up with the term really to critique white feminism and the way in which if you just focused on womanness, you would miss overlapping issues of discrimination that impacted black women. And so that's why black women weren't benefiting from gains that white women were seeing when they just focused on the womanness. So I tend to think about that and focus on that, but understanding that this label of intersectionality has broadened kind of into the common vernacular, and we do understand it as kind of these intersecting. I do ask that we think about it in terms of just overlapping discrimination, right? It's not just overlapping identities, it's overlapping discrimination. And so when we do that, I do bring that work with me at the board, because part of what I'm really passionate about is equity, is educational equity. And when you think about equity and the ways in which people aren't allowed access, it really does move beyond the identity as a black woman, right, which is connoted by that original term. You do have to understand that there are varying overlapping levels of discrimination that exist in the school setting for someone who has a particular type of disability or who has a trans identity or, you know, whatever it might be. And so someone who can understand that and kind of walk in that truth in the school district setting, I think, is really helpful for our students.
Bronwyn.
I would say I think about economic class and its role in running for council or running for any sort of leadership position. I mean, I'm a working class person. You know, I'm not a professional or rich or retired, and a lot of people who run for office are, because you need to have a lot of time devoted. You know, especially when you look at state level stuff. You know, you really have to have a certain job that lets you have that flexibility, or you need to be retired or independently wealthy. And so I think there's a big gap in representation for people who are what I would call working class. And yeah, I don't know how we can better address that, but I see that as a big issue and a big impediment, I guess, for a lot of people running for office.
What barriers or challenges have you experienced?
During the campaign as well, one of my barriers was for a local race, it was full of a lot of vitriol. A lot of photoshopped images on Facebook by local people. And how do you jump? It's real easy to jump in there and get dirty with them. But that's not who I was. And I had long conversations with my mom about how do you keep who you are as a person while someone's attacking you constantly. And it ended up working to my benefit, because I thought, I'm just not going to address them. I'm going to keep being crazy, positive, optimistic Nikki that everybody knows, and it flipped towards the end of the election. People started seeing that I wasn't saying negative things. Those were my main barriers during the election. In my whopping 2 months as an elected official, my barriers that I see now is the good old boy network. I go to state supervisor meetings, and there's four, maybe five women in the auditorium, and we all kind of pack together like, hey, this is great, because there's not a long line in the bathroom.
We're listening to sounds of the Women's Day celebration that was held on Friday in Ames. There was also an opportunity for the audience to ask questions of the panel. One person brought up the statistic that 53% of white women voted for Donald Trump in the last presidential election and asked the question how women, in particular white women, could not have voted for Hillary Clinton. There were a number of interesting responses from the panelists, and here is Monique Binkin responding.
I don't have an answer to your question, but I think this kind of brings us where we started. There is no monolithic identity of womanness, right? And so just like earlier when we talked about intersectionality, if you're just focusing on what it means to be a woman, you're ignoring what it means to be a black woman and that experience. And if you're just focusing on what it means to be a woman, you're ignoring what it means to be a conservative woman or whatever the label is, right? And so I think that if you just say, well, she's a woman, so she therefore should X. And I think we see that when there are women leaders in particular, I'm not going to use any names, in particular political parties who aren't supporting what we would think of as traditional women's issues. And to me, that's one of the ways in which I can understand that, is that if you're only looking at the identity of a woman, you're really missing valuable parts of other people's identities. And so part of the way to fix that, I think, is for all of us to be more complex in our thinking. To stop looking at groups of people as monolithic and say, well, they're black, so they must think this, or they're white, so they must think this. It's really not very meaningful if you don't consider the complexity of identities that we all have.
After the discussion, the organizers posed a question to the participants. They asked, what will you do in the next 5 years to advance women? Participants wrote down their responses, and those will be put into a time capsule to be opened in 5 years. KHOI reporters recorded a few responses. Here are some of the answers to the question, what will you do in the next 5 years to advance women?
One thing I can say is that just kind of as a personal pledge, I think when I hear an injustice or a woman maybe being put down, I would like to say something and to be more of a voice for her. So that's my personal commitment.
I work with students, and it's very inspiring to see how students are really pushing the envelope and demanding change. So for me, that's the drive and the motivating factor in some small way that I can make a difference in moving forward with this.
In the next 5 years, if everyone should just go out and reach out to the younger ones, like in high school, go meet them, tell them what you're coming out for and what you stand for. Carry them along, because in the next 10 years, they are going to be in one office or the other, also trying to represent a woman.
I'll probably continue to do what I'm doing and just lift women up where I can and support people where I can, you know, because if you can't be a wave, be a ripple, you know, make small waves, because we're all in this together.
I try to be supportive of women that I know and even who don't know, who are running for political office and other leadership roles in society.
Well, I think I think about that a lot in my daily life. I have, you know, grandchildren and daughters and a son, and I think it's really important, you know, just to kind of find that confidence and be my best self to help them see that they can have confidence and be them their best self. Also, I work right now with Good Neighbor, like helping to empower people who are living in poverty. And of course, the majority of people I see are women. And so, you know, hopefully just my, you know, being able to offer them assistance through our agency and again, being somewhat of a mentor and encourager for them, you know, hopefully somebody will find inspiration or, you know, the help that I'm able to offer will be like kind of significant to move them into a different place.
I have been working in the area of inclusion and diversity for more than 20 years, and I guess I'll just try to continue to challenge myself and others around me to see where we can, how much further we can go, and hope that when we look at one group, we are not doing it at the expense of others.
Those were some of the sounds of the International Women's Day celebration held on Friday in Ames. Thanks to all the organizers and supporters of that wonderful event, including many folks from KHOI. You're listening to Local Talk on KHOI. I'm your host, Gail Seiler. We've been joined in the studio now by Keith Morgan from Story County Emergency Management. We're going to start by talking about the role of broadcast operations during emergencies. So first, tell us what you mean by that phrase, broadcast operations.
Broadcasters are communicators, and communications during a disaster is very, very important. And there's a pretty broad spectrum of what a broadcaster is. My examination of this came as a part of my planning that I have to do every year, and I was looking at our communications plans and started off with our TV broadcasters down in Des Moines, looking at their capability to stay on the air should we have a complete electrical grid failure. And then it transitions from both TV broadcasts to radio broadcasts, from the regional broadcasters all the way down to what we have here, which is a very localized broadcast. And each of those elements can be very important. Our access to the regional broadcasters can be quite limited because the focus, if we have something that happens here in Story County that isn't of regional impact, it would be difficult to get a regional broadcaster to help communicate. But your radio station focused on folks here in Story County would be much more willing probably to have something that is more specific. So we began to look at that. We call it critical infrastructure because it's infrastructure that isn't owned by the government, but it is stuff that is very important to help out during a disaster and that we focus on when we're looking at how resilient is it to a disaster.
So by broadcast, you're talking about TV, whether it's through the air or cable, radio. Are you also talking about social media and the internet and those kinds of things?
We don't consider, or I don't consider that so much as broadcast, because it is social media and it's a whole different way of interacting with it. Again, for us in emergency management, social media has been absolutely fantastic. During the last I-35 closure, our Facebook page, when we posted about the update on Monday morning, had over 30,000 different interactions with it. And my ability to have direct interaction with the public through any other medium wouldn't be nearly as much. And again, it's two-way. We got feedback from it. I consider broadcast to be much more that which I am interacting with somebody else that controls the mechanisms. Okay. And also, it tends to be a little less interactive.
Okay, just getting information out there.
Yes.
More
mm-hmm.
one way.
Mm-hmm.
So why is it so important to broadcast information during emergencies?
The public is one of the critical parts of any disaster response. By giving them the information that they need to make the right decisions during a disaster, the public can be a fantastic tool to make things better quicker. So if there is a need for you to avoid a certain area, through broadcast, I can get that information out as to avoid this area because of these reasons. And as a matter of fact, here's a different way to get around that because we still want things to go on as much as possible. Or if there's a threat out there, as we would say, maybe there's a hazmat situation where there is a chemical in the air and we tell you to either shelter in place and then we describe what that means to try and avoid allowing air infiltration where you're at, or to try and get out of that area, get away from the danger. The opposite can also happen. Bad information can get out there. Rumors and things that aren't true may actually force people or entice people to do things, to go to a place that is not safe or to do something that is not the appropriate action. So we have to work on both sides. We monitor both social media and broadcast media to make sure that the message is what the public needs to make themselves safer.
It's clear that it is important during emergencies in particular that you get accurate and timely information out there. And the broadcast system, the critical infrastructure as you describe it, is important for that. So the question then is, who's responsible for that and how do you ensure that you're able to do that? Is that some of the issues that you're grappling with?
Sure. It began with an email down to our TV broadcasters down in Des Moines, which is a good example. As emergency management is structured, there's local emergency management, which is my office, which looks out for Story County. There's the state-level emergency management, which tries to look at all of the interactions between those counties and across the state. And then there's the federal level. And through my discussions with one of the TV stations, they indicated that the FCC, which oversees broadcasters, also has avenues to help them out during a disaster. This individual actually happened to have been down south where hurricanes impact the regional broadcast capabilities, and he was describing how there are tools that will help them out. So we're now exploring all of those tools, seeing what all those tools are to make sure that we optimize them and so that we are all working together, that we're not both spending effort on something that the other person is working on, but also to make sure that we're covering our bases as best as possible.
So let's talk about some maybe specific examples that will help people envision what some of the issues are. Suppose there's something that causes power to go out on a large scale in the area. The question then becomes, where do people get their information? Walk us through some of that.
Well, on TV broadcast, we began with that, and we were looking at the question is, when does this become an emergency for emergency management? We have multiple TV broadcasters, and if one of them goes down, is that something that emergency management should be concerned with? Well, there are a lot of other ways that you could get information. Is it when we lose half of the TV stations that we start to be concerned? Is it when we get down to one? Who do we help out? TV broadcasters are a commercial entity, and should we be helping out a commercial entity to continue so that they can continue to reap those benefits of being a commercial entity? So those are all very difficult questions that have to be examined, but that's why we do the planning. This planning causes these questions to be brought up, and we're going to have discussions both at the local, state, and even at the federal level. We have a phone call that's coming up later on today where we're going to all get together and talk through these issues.
Does this have to do with those emergency broadcast system tests that you'll hear on the radio?
Well, it interacts with that because that is a system, again, where there are designated radio stations and television stations that are supposed to get those that information out. And should they have a priority if they have some sort of a problem? And we have to look long term also is what is their responsibility to make sure they have generators and fuel for those generators on their own to be designated as what we call the emergency alert system. Those are all parts of it. And is there any legislative requirements for them to be a part of the EAS, as it's called? So it all interacts, and some of it has been long-term efforts, and some of it might be just-in-time kind of efforts. But we need to look at that and have thought through it so that we at least know where we stand when an emergency might begin.
And radio stations normally interrupt their programming when there's that kind of an emergency, whereas TV stations usually put it across the bottom or the top of their screen in a notice. Are they legally required to do that, or how is that organized?
A lot of that does come from the EAS system out there. A lot of it is just as a public service part of it. So there are many different ways. And again, that's some of the stuff that we look at. What are they required to do? And most of them as a service will interrupt. You've seen it where they have interrupted TV broadcasts when they think it's in the interest of the viewers to get that information. But there is some legal requirements if you're going to be a part of the EAS on what you have to do and how you will respond to those national level emergencies. So it all interacts, and it's all stuff that we look at.
We just assume, I think the public just assumes, that if there's an emergency, somehow there will be someone somewhere that's getting us all the information we need. We just expect that we would be able to turn on our radio or turn on our TV and be informed. But you're saying that that's not always a reasonable assumption.
Well, we want to look at what will it take to keep that up. For instance, they may have a generator out at the transmission site, and they've got to have a connection between where their studios are and the transmission site. And a generator typically will have anywhere between 1 day to 2.5 days worth of fuel. How are we going to get fuel out to it? What if it's snowed and the road is blocked to even get the fuel truck out to the generator? These are all questions that we sit around and ponder as we're looking through it, but it's more along the lines on who has what responsibilities, so that we know that if a broadcaster is having a problem and they know that, they should contact us with what the problem is, mm-hmm. and then we'll put that in with all the other priorities. If fuel was short, should that fuel go to a sheriff deputy's car, or should it go to a generator for a communications platform? We can't make a plan that takes care of all of that all of the time, but these are the kinds of things that we look at ahead of time to set up roles, responsibilities, and a process to make those decisions.
And is there an opportunity for the public to have any input in this planning?
We work through our what we call the jurisdictional executives. When we put together these plans, we send it out to all of the mayors, which is what makes up my commission. The board supervisors also sees them because they have a representative on my commission. And we rely on them that if they think it's an issue that's important to the public, that they get that information out and get inputs and then feed it on back. They're actually the ones that vote to adopt all of our plans. So they're the final authority to meet the public's expectations.
So there are means that people can have input and offer some thoughts or concerns or suggestions for this.
And again, our office is always available. Our phone number is 515-382-7315, and we're on the Story County website under Emergency Management. So and our email address is there also, so that they can send inputs.
And I'm speaking with Keith Morgan from Emergency Management of Story County. And Keith, I believe there's one more thing that we're going to talk about today, and that's Severe Weather Awareness Week at the end of March.
Yeah, folks look out their window and they say, they're not thinking tornadoes and high winds and stuff like that. But it can come very, very rapidly. We have had, as a matter of fact, it's more along the lines of April, May, and June, and somewhat into July, is when our tornado season is.
For this area, three months, this far north.
So that's why we start now. Severe Weather Awareness Week is going to run that last week in March, at the 25th through the 29th. And middle of that is the statewide tornado drill, and that's a perfect time for everybody to really start brushing up on what their plans are when it comes to severe weather. At 10 o'clock, the National Weather Service is going to activate the weather radios and the other systems that we have. And here,
That's Wednesday of that week, March 27th.
Mm-hmm. And what's going to happen here in the county, as long as there isn't the potential for severe weather, our dispatch agencies are going to go ahead and receive that message, ensure that they receive that message, and then they'll go ahead and activate all of the outdoor warning sirens. And we're doing that to make sure that over the long winter that that they haven't been impacted, even though most communities do check them regularly, even in the wintertime. They'll activate the outdoor warning sirens. We'll have the communities check to make sure that all of their outdoor warning sirens are working. And folks that are at home and businesses should hear their the weather radio activate, and that would be a great time for them to do a drill and that reflects what they would do during a tornado. And also check those kits that they have, their survival kits that have food and water, shutoff equipment for the natural gas that's there, refresh their memory on where they would turn off the water for their facility, and also how they would turn off the natural gas that might be a hazard after a tornado. Great time to do that. We'll also be talking during that week about flooding and some of the other potential hazards that are out there.
So Wednesday, March 27th at 10 a.m. is going to kind of be a test run of the tornado sirens and notification system. And so you're suggesting people take that opportunity to do kind of a test run of their own preparedness.
And it's actually two parts, you know, the outdoor warning sirens, which again are for when you're outdoors.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also a test of your weather radio. Make sure that your weather radio is
You're assuming everyone has a weather radio.
As much as I have talked about that here, I'm absolutely positive that everybody's got a weather radio.
So tell us what a weather radio is.
A weather radio is a specific radio that is designed to pick up alerts from the National Weather Service. People tell me, well, I've got my cell phone and like that, but this will wake you up in the middle of the night and let you know what's going on. They are now got it designed so that it'll only activate if there's something going on in this county, although I recommend that if you live right on the county border, you set it up so it'll activate for the county to the west of you or to the south of you, wherever your storms come from, so that you get that alert and get those precious minutes that are needed to avoid the hazard. Again, those tornadoes down in Alabama, they had about 12 minutes warning, which for us should give us plenty of time to get down into the basements. Unfortunately, in a place like that, they don't have that kind of sheltering. Take advantage of it. Get that weather radio so that you can get down to the shelter that you should probably have in your house, or at least have a plan to make it so that you're less vulnerable to a tornado.
Since this seems pretty important, a weather radio, we should all get one, and you leave it on all the time? Is that what the deal is with it?
It sits there. You don't even know it's there because it'll only activate when this particular county or counties that you have selected is called the SAME, S-A-M-E. Look for a weather radio that has that. And then you won't be woken up every time that there's something happening in this region, only when there's something happening in the counties that you're concerned about. And it'll sit there. You won't even know about it until, you know, in the middle of the night. If something dangerous is happening, you'll know about it because the alarm is rather loud. But that's what you need.
So one last thing on that. Roughly how much does this cost, just so people know?
About $30 is for the bottom end one. You can get some that actually, I have one down in my basement that doesn't have that specific mode, but it's got the ability for a hand crank to charge up the battery. It's solar, so I leave it in the windowsill, so it's always charged up. Okay. It's got a flashlight on it and a regular radio on it.
You're prepared.
Well, I'm trying to be.
And that's what we should all model Keith on that. Thank you very much.
Thanks for the opportunity to talk about this.
We've been speaking with Keith Morgan from Story County Emergency Management. This is KHOI Community Radio, and you've been listening to Local Talk. I'm your host, Gail Seiler. Local Talk is broadcast on KHOI at 7 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m. on Monday and Wednesday, and 7 a.m., noon, and 5 p.m. on Friday. You can also listen to Local Talk on our website, khoifm.org. Local Talk was engineered by Cynthia McClure. Our theme song is Backtracking by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Remember, your participation as audience and supporter is what makes KHOI possible and meaningful. Thank you for listening, and see you again on the radio.